Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Our focus today is on the science and the art of gardening, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Bruce Gravens, a master gardener here in Roseburg. Welcome, Bruce. Can you tell us more about yourself?
So yes, I've been gardening most of my life. Family always had a garden. I had a garden when I moved away from home. It's been a career in high tech, computer design, chip design, that kind of thing. But about 15 years before I decided to retire, I was trying to figure out what am I going to do? You know, living in the country seemed like the thing and getting back to the farm seemed like the thing. So I joined the Master Gardener program while I was still working and, you know, just use that as an educational and to really test the theory that when I quit doing the real job, what's my new real job going to be? And then moved to Roseburg here about 8 years ago. Moved out into the country. We're out in Florney Valley. That's kind of what's going on.
Well, cool. I am not a gardener. I am an animal person. In fact, I'm a master naturalist. So I knew the Master Gardener program through the Master Naturalist program. But what impresses me is that the folks in that program really do outreach. We master naturalists are supposed to educate the public and help maintain the ecosystem's health and whatnot. But master gardeners really seem to apply a lot of time in reaching out and helping other gardeners.
You know, that's the roots of the Master Gardener program. FDR started the program back during the Depression days, where he would use the expertise in the grant universities, in our case, OSU. You know, those grant universities were charged with the extension agents, and the idea was to teach the extension agents to teach local gardeners and farmers so they could go out and be a broader outreach into the community to teach people during the Depression how to grow enough food and, you know, to sustain themselves during the Depression. And like every government program, once it started, it's pretty much impossible to end it. Here we are today. The Master Gardener program in Douglas County is focused primarily on education and demonstration. So we've got the big demonstration garden out at River Forks area. Mm-hmm. It's called the Discovery Garden. And in there, you'll find lots of different venues from rock gardens to xeriscape to Japanese gardens, a rose garden, a children's garden. There's about 30 different little venues. And the idea is that people could come out thinking about what they want to do in their landscape and look at those gardens and see what's growing well and what they might do in their gardening. Here we have a little vegetable demonstration garden where people can come out and see what vegetables are growing and get ideas about how to grow those different vegetables. And then we have a very large, what we call Victory Garden, back from, you know, harkening back to our roots. And the Victory Garden is basically a garden that we do where all the vegetables get donated to a food bank. We do several thousand pounds of vegetables go to the food bank every year from there.
And so these are all master gardeners who are volunteering their time to work on these three parks, I think you told me about. Gardens.
Yes. Our arrangement with the county park service, which the land is all county park service land, is that you have to be certified master gardeners to actually work there.
Well, I inherited some gardens out here, and I am not a gardener. I have a magnificent rose garden, which I think I've killed pretty much a lot of them. And I inherited a vegetable garden down below our area, which I maintained, and I got a little stuff out of this year, but due to no fault of my own, I let most of that go to the side too. So this is going to be excellent for me because I've wasted a lot of opportunities, I think, here. So, but one thing I have learned is that the United States, and I guess all over the world, is divided up into zones. Is that right? Gardening zones. And that tells you when you should start doing different types of stuff. Is that correct? And if so, what are we?
We've moved from a zone 9 to a zones, you know, 9A to 8B or something like that. Uh-huh. To be honest, I wouldn't put much credence in the zones. Okay. They're very useful when you go to a nursery, you know, you're going to buy a shrub or you're going to buy a tree or you're going to buy something like that that's going to be uh-huh. there for a while. Our microclimates in and around Roseburg, Douglas County, vary dramatically. You can go 4 miles and your frost dates and your temperatures and your rainfall will change dramatically. So I wouldn't put a lot of credence in that. If you're going to, like I said, if you're going to buy shrubs or trees or something like that, that's going to be in the ground for a lengthy period of time. then the zones are kind of helpful. That's going to keep you from buying a palm tree and planting it here.
Right.
People do. There are palm. There's a really nice palm tree down over by the extension office that's been there for a generation or so and seems to survive. I wouldn't recommend planting it, but, you know, there you go. Right. But there are different zones, and it's much better to think about getting into the gardening and keeping track of what you're doing, keeping track of what your weather's like, and then, you know, going from there and making adjustments based on your own observations, just because it varies so much from one site within the county to another.
And our weather is kind of tricky. When I came out here, we looked at the property in February and we closed in May, and it was, of course, green, 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 and rainy during those times. And I had no idea when summer came how yellow and dried out this area became.
Right.
So that was, I had no idea. You know, I was told when you move to Oregon, you take rain gear and it rains all year. And I had no idea that we were actually in a fire zone hazard area because of the dry.
You know, that has a lot to do with how the climate has moved around. There was a time when this was very dry, you know, much drier than it is now.
Huh.
And we moved through a cycle in the 1800s and early 1900s where it was very wet. I mean, there's old timers that'll talk about growing tomatoes here in Roseburg where they never ripened. It never got warm enough or dry enough for them to ripen. They just rotted away on the vine. They never got ripe. As we move in what appears to be a drier, warmer climate, now it's going back to that where it's kind of like, you know, it's going to be really green and wet all winter, and then it's going to be bone dry all summer, which actually for gardeners is perfect.
How so? Tell me more about that.
Well, now you can control the water. If it's raining all the time, now things can get overwatered, underwatered. There's a lot of pathogens that are bred by rain hitting the soil and bouncing up on the leaves. And when it's dry all through your vegetable growing season, you can now irrigate in a way that nothing bounces, you know, no water splashes up on the leaves. And a lot of those pathogens then can't exist anymore. So it's a lot easier to control. In fact, even here, there's a lot of gardeners that use high tunnels, you know, plastic covers over their vegetables to even be able to control that water moisture better during the shoulder seasons, during the early spring and the late summer. So they're able to get their vegetables in a lot earlier because they can keep the soil from being so wet and so cold.
So what would be the easiest way to start? I mean, this may be a very simple question, but if you just did move here, let's say what time of the year we are right now, December, and this is a crazy December. I'm used to 3 feet of snow in December. Is there something I should be doing right now in gardens to prepare for the spring or to even prepare my garden? Is there something I could be doing right now?
Best thing you can do right now is stay off of it. Right now, the soil is going to be super, super wet. And every time you step on it, it's going to compact it and make it harder and harder and harder. And that compaction can take years to undo, where it just, you know, you'll break it up, but it'll be marble sized little balls of clay that are, you know, like rocks. And they just don't hold the moisture and they don't release their nutrients to the vegetables. So the best thing right now is to stay off your garden. If you've got raised beds or something like that, where you can, you know, walk around and not step right where you're going to be growing your vegetables, this would be a great time for you to start adding mulch. If you happen to have oak leaves or any kind of deciduous tree leaf that's laying around your property, then pile that up on top of that bed, let that all rot down here in the wintertime. And that'll be very useful for your soil. The last thing you want to do is do anything where you get in and you're messing with it. You're moving the soil around. You just want to leave it alone until it gets much drier than it is now.
And when we came out here, apparently the lady who had this house was quite a gardener. And she has a bunch of raised beds. Even the ones that are on the ground are kind of raised, like at least 3 inches. And she had them all covered with some kind of not a sheet, not plastic, certainly, but it almost seemed like a fabric sheet. Does that make sense?
Kind of a white thing?
No, it was black, but it was kind of fabric-y feeling. And I think water goes through it.
Right. She was probably trying to keep the weed seeds off of it. So if earlier in the year, as the grasses are drying out and the weeds are starting to release their seeds, if you've got beds laying open, that gives you a real opportunity for those weed seeds to get in there and start growing on your beds. If you don't have plants in there, you can put that fabric over it. It's called lawn fabric, weed block fabric. It goes by a lot of different names, but it's just a real thin mesh. Like you say, it's not really woven. It's kind of just a meshy thing. And it'll keep the weeds from coming up. And, you know, if they're in the seeds already there, they'll germinate, but it'll be too dark and they'll just die off. And if weeds are, you know, seeds are coming in on top of it, you can carefully pull that. When you pull it off, make sure whatever's collected on top of it goes somewhere other than in your garden bed.
I think I probably emptied it all right back into the garden.
Yeah, well, that happens. And the truth of the matter is, weeds are really, really efficient at spreading their seeds. So a lot of the things you do to avoid the weed seeds getting into your garden are pretty ineffective. You know, these things that become masters of getting their seeds where they need to be and having those seeds last long enough in the soil that when conditions are right, they'll germinate. You know, weeds are kind of the salvation for soil. If you go out into these burned areas, even now, if you go up to where the fires were this year and it's just black and ash, you go up, mess around in that woods hardly at all, and you're going to see green coming up everywhere. And those are the weeds. The weeds, they're there to protect the soil after there's some traumatic event. So anytime soil gets left bare, those weeds come in, start rebuilding the soil structure, start rebuilding all the microorganisms that get going before the weeds that we like, the shrubs and the natives, come back in and establish themselves. You know, so weeds are extremely helpful in recovery efforts. And if you think about what your garden is a place where something awful has happened. You know, all the natural plants are gone. It's bare soil laying there. And those weeds are like, hey, that's my home. I got to go. So that's why they're always there.
Oh, I love that, though. You have a good word for the weeds. I mean, we finally put a good word in for weeds. So they are a natural and an essential part of a healthy ecosystem. And maybe a garden isn't necessarily.
A garden is, you know, that's why you have to work at it so hard. You know, you don't have to work at a woodland. You don't have to work at an old growth forest. You don't have to do anything. Anytime you're working hard in nature, you're fighting it. And, you know, and by the way, it will win. You're not going to win. You know, eventually you're going to quit, and it's not. Nature will always find its way back. It takes a long time.
So I am removing all the weeds from an area where I'm going to have this magnificent garden, right? Because I'm going to feed my family all year, right? That's my vision.
Yeah, right.
And how technical do I have to be? Like I know enough about pH balance and pH levels and whatnot. How technical do I have to be able to be successful? Do I need to determine the pH level of the soil? Why is that important? Do I need to modify it? Can I go with what's already there?
The answer is yes. You can go with what's already there. Are you going to get the largest, earliest tomatoes in the world? No. If you'll just give them soil that's been dug up enough that, you know, friable, that the roots can get into it, and you give it the right amount of water, they're going to grow. And then over time, you can start thinking about how you might improve that soil, how you might improve that environment. And when you get into that stage, now you can say, oh, I'm going to do a soil test, and I'm going to see what the pH is, and I'm going to see what adjustments I need to make. You know, that's one of the things, if you're concerned about that at this point, and you can get on the garden and not walk where you're going to be growing your vegetables. You could do a soil test, find out that your pH is off a little bit, and you could apply some lime or some calcium to adjust that pH a little bit.
And how do you know what it should be?
That's the key. So you need to get a soil test. We can talk a little bit about how to do that. The most cost-effective way of doing soil tests is to get a sample and take it down to the extension office. The Master Gardener Program has a soil testing facility, and we'll test that soil for you. I think there's a nominal fee, 10 or 15 bucks, to get that done. And it'll come back and say, oh, your pH is this. It should have been that. You need to apply so many pounds of lime per 100 feet or 1,000 square feet or some metric. And then you can go down to DC Co-op and get that lime and spread it out. And there you go. And because you're doing it this time of year, the natural rain is going to water that in and get it mixed into the soil. So you're not trying to do something at the last minute in the spring.
So that is perhaps something we should be doing now.
You could, you know, if you're at that point in your gardening where you say, I really want to start improving things. If you're saying, you know, I just like to get a garden going to see if that's something I want to do, then don't bother. Put your mulch on there. If you've got leaves laying around your yard that you need a home for, instead of taking them to the dump or having somebody take them to the dump for you, or for God's sake, burning them, collect them up and put them on your garden beds. That's an excellent thing to do. And it's excellent in lots of different ways. Those leaves provide overwintering habitat for a lot of things, for a lot of reptiles, for a lot of spiders and, and insects, beetles, and all kinds of good and bad things. You know, you kind of want that balance in your garden. And so taking all those leaves and piling them in there is an excellent way to both improve the soil and to keep the bigger environment of your garden area sort of balanced out. Because there's a lot of things you're going to do that's going to throw that out of balance. You're going to go in and knock out all those weeds. Well, those weeds are providing habitat and home for all kinds of insects and things. Some of them you're going to want later on when the aphids come. You'd like for those insects that like to eat aphids, you'd like to have them be really healthy and hungry when that happens. So, but when you start clearing all those weeds away, well, you're going to disturb things. If you're going to have a garden, you got to disturb things. So it's not something to really worry about. But yeah, my recommendation, people want to get started in gardening, is just plain old start. Start out with a small thing. Look at the vegetables you really like to eat and grow them. You know, there's something that grows here. So peppers, tomatoes, eggplant. You know, most of the stuff that you find in the vegetable area at the grocery store are things that'll grow here. You know, look at those things and see what you grow and say, I'd like to try to grow that. Buy a packet of seeds. It'll say right on there when to plant them. Go ahead and plant them. Now, having said that, once you decide, yes, I want a garden and I want to have really good gardening, you need to start looking at, when do I plant? What kind of plants are going to be the ones that really do well? Among the tomatoes, how am I using the tomatoes? Am I just eating them or am I canning them? And now you can start expanding your knowledge into what varieties you really want. How do they do well here? And then keep growing the knowledge base and growing what you're doing. The other thing that's really helpful at this point is to start keeping notes. The very first day, start keeping notes. Start saying, you know, when was my last frost date? You Google first and last frost date, you're going to get in Roseburg, you're going to get an answer. But that doesn't really mean that's what it is at your place. To be honest, you talked about your garden being low and your roses being higher up. You could get 10, 15, 20 days difference in the frost dates between those two locations.
Yeah, the frost date depends. The seeds would tell you plant so many days after the last frost. Is that why we care?
That's exactly right. All of your warm vegetables, your tomatoes, your peppers, particularly let's talk about those two. If you get a frosty night after you've planted them, there's a good chance they're gone. You're going to have to replant. Now, that's not the end of the world, right? Let's not, you know, start pulling our hair out. You say, oh, okay, well, that was a little early. Let me go get some more and replant them. Because it's always a game we all play about how close to that edge do we want to walk. But if you start keeping a record, and it's not that hard, you wake up in the morning, you say, did it get below 32 last night? And if it did, you write the date down. If it didn't, you don't write the date down. Somewhere around June, you can look back and see what was the last date I wrote down and then log that away. And the next year, do the same thing. You do the same as you get into the mid-October timeframe. Did it freeze last night? Nope, don't write the date down. When does the first time
Gotcha. Grow?
And write down that first frost date. And that gives you your last first frost date and your last frost date. And that really establishes the window, if you don't do anything else, of when you can plant and when you can grow peppers and tomatoes.
That makes me think that'd be a good way to involve your kids who are learning to tell temperature and take notes and make a graph. That'd be a good job for them to have and call it part of their education.
And learn to pay attention. Start wandering around. If you've got property, start wandering around looking at the trees and saying, when do you start seeing the little buds swelling where the leaves are going to come out? When do you see something starting to happen, right? You can do that same thing with your roses. You go out and you start looking to when do I see those little buds coming out? Definitely know when that time comes, you've kind of missed the window for when you're gonna prune them. Although, to be honest, roses are so bulletproof, you can prune them any time of the year you want. They're really tough guys.
I might call you on that one because mine. Well, let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with Master Gardener Bruce Gravens. Okay, so we were talking about pH. When I inherited this garden, we had several raised gardens. We had several raised off the ground about 3 inches and some raised off 3 feet. The plants we've been speaking of so far are peppers and tomatoes and the common ones and I guess cucumbers and such. Are those all the same, requiring the same pH levels? So does it matter to me? Do each one of these beds have to be tested separately for pH for those type of generic plants?
all your vegetables, it's the same window of pH, right around neutral. A little bit acidic is okay, but not a lot. And our soils here almost always are going to be a little on the acidic side, just because of our climate and because of where all these soils, you know, the kind of rock all this soil was made from. It's most likely going to be acidic. They'll test that. No, you don't have to be real precise about any kind of pH thing in terms of vegetable growth. You know, there are things that you can manipulate. If you're growing hydrangeas, you can make it more pH and you'll get, I'll forget which way it goes, but you'll get the blue colored ones, or make it more alkaline, you'll get the red colored ones. That's one plant that's sensitive to the pH and will change its bloom color based on its soil it's growing in. But for the most part, slightly acidic away from neutral is ideal for all vegetables. Our blueberries, which are, you know, a big thing here, want quite an acidic soil. You may actually have to make your soil a little bit more acidic, but probably not. Probably they'll do fine just with the natural soil. You just don't do anything to make it more alkaline.
When we took over this house, it was like middle May. She had planted potatoes already for us in one of the raised gardens. So she planted them in that raised garden probably because of the depth. Is that the only reason? Is there a reason why some vegetables or anything would do better in a higher raised garden?
All the vegetables would like to have about 2 foot, a foot to 2 foot of good soil.
That's a lot more than I would have thought.
They don't require it, but they'll do better. You know, as you get more advanced in gardening, you're always trying to figure out how to make your quality soil deeper. And there's things you can do mechanically to get yourself good soil down about a foot. And then after that, you need to rely on root structures and kind of the way you deal with things. One of the things that I can recommend in terms of root soil is not to pull your plants out at the end of the season, your tomatoes and pepper plants.
Do not pull them out.
Don't pull them out. Just cut them off at the ground level, leave the roots in the soil and lay them over. And by doing that, those roots, however far they got down in the soil, as they rot away, they'll leave holes down in that soil. That'll start loosening up that deep subsoil for you. And there's plants like, there's what they call digger turnips, the big daikon type radishes. And there are digger turnips. There's several root crops that are good for livestock. They're not really something that we would want to eat, but they'll put their roots way down in the soil and start making the soil depth a lot better. Speculating about her potatoes.
When must she have planted those? And we were harvesting them by end of June easily.
Yeah, the traditional is to plant them on St. Patrick's Day. Actually, here in Roseburg, that's about 3 or 4 weeks early. And you run the risk of them coming up, their leaves breaking surface and getting a frost at that time. A couple weeks after St. Patrick's Day would be a good time to do that. One of the things you can do here in Roseburg is this, the weather is cool enough in the fall through the winter that you can leave those potatoes in the ground and harvest them out of that raised bed. What some people do is grow them just like tomatoes. There's all kinds of different, you know, there's early potatoes and mid-season potatoes and late potatoes. So you can grow a variety so you've got something to harvest throughout the summer. Most of your main crop tomatoes, potatoes, really aren't going to be ready until the frost kills the tops off in the fall. And those, if I had them in a raised bed of 3 foot, I would actually at that point put plastic over the top of it to let the soil dry out a little bit, keep it from being soggy all the time, plastic or tarp, anything that'll shed the water. And then when you want potatoes, just open that up and dig down in there and harvest what you want. Alrighty. Leave the rest of them in, and you can leave them all the way into March when it's time to plant again. And comes time to plant them in, make sure you've harvested everything and then replant them and away you go. So you can keep that as a potato bed forever.
So they won't rot.
Yeah. If you can keep them cool and dry enough, they'll actually store better there than they would under the cabinet or in a cool place in your house or something like that, where they're going to start drying out and getting soft.
I'm that gardener that goes to Lowe's or Home Depot and I buy the plants that are already about 3 inches, 4 inches, 5 inches tall. So I buy the zucchini, the cucumber, the peppers. I don't plant the seeds. And so it's a hodgepodge. I just go and see what looks pretty to me, what looks like I recognize the name. And these, I threw them all in the same bed, not the potato bed, because that was already full of potatoes. There was no rhyme or reason. What is wrong with my story? In other words, I was putting cucumbers with peppers, with tomatoes, with all in the same garden.
There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, there's a whole movement called the food forest movement, where they do exactly that. They don't plant in the traditional rows. They spread everything together. and then kind of wander around the garden looking for whatever it is they might. That's not my style. I'm the traditional 40s tomato row and a pepper row and a cucumber row kind of guy. But there's absolutely nothing wrong putting them all together. They're fine.
Does one vegetable or another increase the pH of the soil and hurt the next plant over chemically wise?
There are people who think so, but I have personally not seen any science that supports it. There's a whole discussion on companion planting. You know, you plant basil with tomatoes.
Is that because they work well together or they taste good together?
Because people think they work well together. I've yet to see any science-based studies that would support that argument. I plant my tomatoes and basil together because they're spaced. Tomatoes go in round bins, and so there's little pie-shaped spaces between each of those round bins. And I put a basil plant in there just because it fills the space. Tomato plants that don't get basil don't do any better than the ones that do. And the basil that are on their own out where they get full sun do a lot better than the ones that are being shaded out by the tomatoes. And there's no difference in taste. I personally have seen nothing. And like I said, I haven't seen any science to support it.
What about insects? I've heard some plants, maybe marigold or something, I'm not sure, wards off a particular type of insect. Would it keep insects away from some plants that those insects might prey on? Plants work well together because they protect each other. One wards off insects that might attack another plant.
The marigold one is one there has been some research on. Particular variety of Mexican marigold is very effective at discouraging a variety of nematode that attacks the roots of most of your vegetables. So you can put this Mexican marigold in there and it'll supposedly scare off those.
So you could intersperse it.
Now, here in Roseburg, Douglas County, we really don't have a nematode problem with anything. The nematodes that are here are almost all beneficial, and the ones that aren't very active. This isn't a really great environment for them. So that nematodes aren't a real problem around here. I wouldn't worry about that too much. There is a tomato blight, which is a bacteria. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's bacteria or fungal. I can't remember now which way it goes. But growing and leaving the waste from brassicas, from cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, kales, instead of cleaning that off, leaving that on the ground, when that rots off, it gives off a mild sulfuric acid when those rot, and that destroys that particular pathogen. I did my original master gardening was done down in Santa Clara. We had it where we had a major tomato blight problem. And there in our trial gardens, we grew brassicas throughout the winter as a cover crop. And then in the spring, just cut them off and let them rot on the ground. And it was a pretty dramatic impact. The grounds that we didn't have it on, the grounds we do have it on, had a pretty impressive impact on the amount of blight. Now, once again, blight's not a big problem up in Douglas County. Mm-hmm.
Right.
I've, in the 8 or 9 years that I've been growing here, I haven't seen any blight at all on my tomatoes. And I do, you know, a modest number of tomato plants. I've got, you know, 30 varieties and three of each. So approaching 100 plants, very densely packed. No blight at all.
Is there any advantage to, like, my tomatoes? I usually buy them from Lowe's, again, or one of those stores, in the bucket they came from. And I leave them in the bucket they came in, and I leave them on my deck and whatnot. The size of the bucket notwithstanding, is there a reason a tomato would do better or worse in a bucket on your deck than in the ground that could be 3, 4, 5 feet deep? Or,
you know, if you think about a garden, you know, the soil is the soil, and the tomato plants are well adapted. They're going to find what they need in that soil. In a bucket, it's up to you. You've got to provide everything. Got to provide the nutrients. You got to provide everything that tomato plant needs, and anything that's lacking, you know, it just isn't going to find because it isn't there. So it'll always do better from a nutritional point of view being in the ground, and they will be more nutritious for you to eat if they're in the ground.
I did not think
now,
of that.
What's the counter argument? Well, on your patio, a covered patio, it's going to be a light frost is going to be less of an impact because they're just going to be covered. Uh-huh. They're not going to be as frost affected. The counter to that, though, is because they're in a bucket, that bucket, the soil is going to cool in that bucket a lot faster than your soil that's going to cool. there's pros and cons. If you've got decent soil and you can keep the deer away and that kind of thing, I would always recommend getting in the ground. Getting in the ground as soon as you possibly can.
Now,
you know, our seasons are short compared to what a lot of tomatoes want, and for that matter.
Yeah.
So the closer you can get to that, you know, last frost date, getting them in the ground, the better off you're going to be. Although the more risk, you're going to have to go down to Lowe's and buy another one. The other thing you want to do when you're planting, even if you wanted to buy it in a pot and you wanted to grow it in a pot on your deck or something like that, you want to replant that tomato and pepper plant for that matter, very deep. So you want between a half and two thirds of the green material of the plant under soil when you plant it. And you're going to bury at least a half to two thirds of the plant under soil. Of the green part.
Okay.
So you're going to, you know, take it out of whatever you bought it in. If you're going to put it in the ground, you're going to do the same thing. Dig a hole, put it down in that hole and cover it up. So at least a half to two thirds of that plant, the leaves and all that stuff are covered up with soil.
And why? Can you tell me more?
A couple of things. Yes, they will recover from being replanted much faster. They'll have a deeper root system and a more significant root system because roots will come out from those stems planted. So you'll get a bigger root mass and a deeper root mass. And because of that, you're going to be able to use less water. You're going to have a healthier plant. It's going to grow much more robustly. And you're going to have less risk of you planting it and it dying right away just from the shock of being planted. It's down in the soil. It, you know, you're removing some of the leaves from putting off their moisture. You know, so the fact that you've disturbed the roots is going to have less of an impact. It's just, you're going to have a healthier plant at the end of the day.
And is this the same with tomatoes and cucumbers and squash and all those, or just tomatoes?
All of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I never recommend buying root vegetables, but you know, you can go and you'll find beets and you'll find all kinds of root vegetables. Those you don't want to plant deeper. Anything that when you look at the plant, it looks like all the leaves are coming from one spot at the surface, not a stem. If it's got a stem, plant it deep. There's no stem. If the roots are all coming from one place, don't bury those stems.
Gotcha. Okay.
But like that lettuce, you wouldn't plant lettuce deep. Plant
that makes
lettuce
sense.
They're all coming right from the surface there.
Now, you had said about the tomatoes in the bucket. You have to provide everything for them, which I assume means also fertilizer. Again, I'm a person who doesn't do anything but water. So how important is fertilizer in general for the garden or the potted plants?
Well, for potted plants, it's absolutely required. You know, they'll just fail otherwise. Now, most reputable nurseries are providing that soil with a lot of slow-release fertilizer in there. So it should keep them going for a while. But if you're doing it in a pot, you really ought to put probably, you know, a liquid fertilizer that you mix with the water you're watering them with at about half strength, and just always water them with about half strength fertilizer if you're doing it in the pots. If you're doing it in the garden, if it's like you say, I'm just starting a garden, I really haven't done anything, then you'll want to put some fertilizer in the soil, dig it in a few inches, you know, water it in really good. You'll want to use some kind of basically the cheapest fertilizer you can buy that says all three numbers are the same. So there's three numbers on the fertilizer: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Uh-huh. You just want them all to be the same. Put that in. Now, as you become more experienced as a gardener, now you may say, gee, I want to become organic. I'm only going to use organic fertilizer. Now, that's quite a challenge. It's doable, but it's quite a challenge to do. I don't necessarily recommend it unless you just, you know, are into that kind of thing and you really want to be organic. Then, you know, you signed up for a lot of headache, but have at it. Probably what I'd really recommend is keep working on your soil to get it to the point where it's nutritious enough. You don't have to add any fertilizer. And the key to that is, first place, getting your soil test done so you know what the problem is.
Okay.
You need more nitrogen, you need more potassium, you need more phosphorus, whatever. Probably it's unlikely with our soils that you'll ever need much phosphorus. Once again, because of the rock, all the soil. You know, you realize all of our soil is rock.
Right.
It started with stones, and they just got worn away till they became soil. But if you start working on your soil, you're adding the leaves all, you know, during the winter time. I add enormous amounts of horse manure to my soil. Horse manure is a resource that's just, you know, available. You drive around the countryside, you see any horse stables, you know, there's a pile of manure somewhere, and, you know, just keep digging around till you find it. And most of the people that are running the horse stables would love for you to haul it away.
Right.
You know, some of the bigger operations actually haul it to the dump and pay, you know, Roseburg Public Works, a dump service to take their horse manure. So it's the extent that you can get it, it's keeping it out of the waste stream. You know, so I put in, you know, 6 to 12 inches of horse manure on my soil every winter, late fall when the crops.
Winter. Okay. Yeah. Are we too late? We can do that right now still?
If you can keep from walking on the soil. And if you're hauling horse manure around in wheelbarrows and trying to do it, it's really hard to stay off of where you're growing. Right. So I try to get that done as the tomatoes and, you know, as your summer crops are failing, then I'll start cutting those things off, laying them on the ground, and then covering them up with horse manure before the rains get started. And then I try to stay off of it after that. Now, I do some winter gardening, doing more and more as time goes on. So like this year's been great for it because we haven't had that much cold. You know, we had that 3 or 4 days of the mid 20s, really finished everything off that wasn't ready for that. So that just cleared the space. And now, you know, lettuces and all the brassicas and the kales and the, you know, Swiss chard, all your broccolis, cauliflowers, all that stuff is doing great now. And you could, you know, if you were really careful and your ground isn't super, super muddy, you know, you could get cauliflower, broccoli, kales, and that kind of thing. You could get those in the ground. Just be really careful with the soil. Don't be smushing it up too much.
Okay.
You want to be as gentle as you possibly can getting it planted.
Okay.
Because every little bit you move that soil is going to compress it some. Anyway, if you did those, then, you know, those will grow really good. You know, even when we get that foot of snow, a lot of times they'll, especially the kales, will just start sprouting again. The lettuce will be done. But, you know, that's, you know, there's things like that that you can grow. But, you know, once, you know, if you can in the fall before the rain start, get as much organic material as you can on top of the beds that are finished up. Now, you know, public service, I need to make a warning. When you put horse, you go to the farm and get horse manure, you don't want to harvest anything from that horse manure for at least 6 months.
Oh, why? Tell me more.
Well, there is a scientific potential for some pathogens. Think E. coli, think salmonella, that kind of thing. And so you want time for the natural bacteria and funguses that belong in the soil to attack and kill and eat those things that don't belong in the soil. E. coli, salmonella, that stuff can't survive in the soil over any period of time. And so if you put that manure down, you know, maybe you've had a chance to kind of dig it in a little bit or not, doesn't matter. Laying down the soil, the natural organisms that are adapted to living in the soil will take over and destroy the ones that aren't adapted.
Got it. Okay.
And so it'll make it safe for you to harvest things from later. So for instance, in my beds that I'm do, you know, broccolis and cauliflowers and lettuces and now, I didn't put horse manure on those in the fall.
Okay.
Everything else got it. And then next year I'll grow those somewhere where I did put horse manure in this year.
Gotcha.
So that I can get some into that soil.
All right.
And if you do that for 2 or 3 years, your soil will become rich enough that you don't have to add any fertilizer. You know, that's a much more sustainable process than adding fertilizers, especially the non-organic ones, which, you know, I recommend it, but, you know, there's a warning with those. The way they make those results in, you know, various salts that are pretty harmful to the ecosystem of your garden. So while they're adding nutrients for the plant, they're also destroying other things. So to the extent that you can avoid that by getting your soil in good shape, having lots of organic material in there that's rotting down and naturally providing those nutrients is a much better path. You know, and thinking about winter gardening and what you could do, especially if it stays warm like it is now for a while, another 3 or 4 weeks, you could go in and plant fava beans very gently. Just press the bean into the soil. Don't dig it up or don't do anything because you just really don't want to disturb that soil that much. But just get them in there and let those fava beans grow in that soil. There's two things that'll come from that. The first thing, which is food. So once they get up to about 6 to 8 inches tall, you can start cutting the tips off. That is very much like, well, it is a variety. Fava beans are a variety of in the pea family. And you can cut those off and eat them in salads or in stir fries or stuff like that. So you get some vegetable value out of it. And eventually, you know, if you've planted enough of them, they'll just keep growing and you can't eat enough to keep up with them. The minute that you see anything that looks like a flower, you want to cut them down, cut them off, and lay them on the ground. So what's happening now is as that plant is growing, peas, beans, all of the legume family has the ability to take nitrogen out of the air. Our air is about 80% nitrogen. It's able to take that nitrogen out of the air and store it on little nodules on the roots. If the plant dies before those nodules are consumed, that will go into the soil and put nitrogen in the soil for your tomato plants to consume in the summer. Now, if you let the legume bloom and set seed again, well, the way that whole plant is working during the growing stage, it's pulling nitrogen out of the air and putting it in the nodules. Once it starts to blossom and produce seeds, it's pulling the nitrogen out of those nodules to make the, you know, to make the seeds and make the flowers. So if you let it go to maturity, you haven't done anything for the soil other than keeping something growing on the surface of the soil. And keeping something growing on the surface of the soil is a very helpful thing to do.
Why is that?
Well, because no plant can feed itself. A plant can't exist in its own, on its own. The way the plant works, every plant works, is it creates a symbiotic relationship with a whole bunch of different varieties of funguses and bacteria. Funguses and bacteria find the nutrients that the plant needs and provides it to the plant. The plant puts sugars and starches into the soil that the bacteria and the funguses eat. A little symbiotic relationship. When you have your soil in the wintertime like this, and the weeds haven't started growing on them, they're just, it's bare soil. Those sugars and starches aren't going into the soil, and the populations of those funguses and bacteria that are useful start dying away. They don't die away permanently. They don't. I mean, they're omnipresent, and they've been here since the beginning of time. So it's not like you can wipe them out. You can't do that, but you can reduce their populations. To the extent that you can keep their populations high in the spring where you plant your tomato plant or your pepper plant or cucumber or whatever, there's a lot of them in the soil, and they're there ready to immediately start feeding that plant and getting the sugars and starches from that plant that they want. So they're plentiful and they're ready to go. So your plants will take off faster. If you've done a lot during the fall and summer, or fall and winter, to lower those populations, so there's nothing growing on there. Maybe you've done a lot of digging, which messes up those things. So those populations are very low. You'll plant your tomato and pepper plant in there, and it'll sit there and frown at you for a few weeks. And you wonder, what's with you? You're not putting on any new leaves. You're not doing anything. You're just standing there staring at me. Well, it's waiting for the populations of bacteria and fungus to come back up to a level where they can start feeding the plants so it can start growing again.
Okay. This is interesting. This is a lot more chemistry than I thought about.
There's an endless amount of chemistry. And that's why I tell people, you know, if you want to start gardening, start. You don't have to know anything. Just put a plant in the ground, look at it. If it's dry, give it some water. If it's wet, don't. you know, and, you know, go along, but just start learning. And when you find out, you'll find that there's a lifetime of new things that you can learn.
And it seems like just a little interest, a little knowledge, and a little effort can get you started and can even have a significant impact, you know, a benefit beyond your own interest, and even maybe the interest of, you know, climate change considerations and all, if we are all contributing to this growing effort.
That's true. Now, I should say that when you were talking about the gardening before, our supply chain for vegetables and fruits and vegetables and stuff to eat is extremely efficient, very, very efficient. There is no way as a home gardener that you can grow tomatoes cheaper than you can go down to the store and buy a can of canned tomatoes.
Right.
You are not going to save money gardening. You know, that just is not going to happen.
Okay.
If we're just too super efficient. Now, could you take a little bit out of the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere because now fewer trucks don't have to deliver vegetables for you?
Right.
Sure. But it is an interesting phenomenon that, like, for instance, farmers markets. Farmers markets create much more greenhouse gases than do grocery stores, because every farmer's got his vehicle. He's got to drive there and drive back for a very small amount of vegetables compared to what a long haul trucker is going to be able to do. And, you know, those trucks are much more efficient than your 30-year-old pickup is going to be. And to the extent that we can electrify those trucks, you know, that could be the way the trend is going. The mass production of food is becoming more and more green, you know, less environmentally harmful, much, much faster than anything us home gardeners can do. What we can do is get much tastier tomatoes, much more interesting peppers, much more interesting cucumbers. We can learn to eat things when they're in season. You know, one of the childhood memories, it was sweet corn. And, you know, you waited all year for that first sweet corn. And now you can go eat sweet corn every day if you want. You can go to the market and buy sweet corn every day. Right. And you lose kind of that wonder and anticipation of that first ear of sweet corn. You know, if you do it right, that first ear of sweet corn is going to be better than anything you're going to buy at any market.
That's true. The taste is incredible, right?
Yeah, because you're going to go harvest it, you know, shuck it on, you know, you're going to start the water boiling. You're going to go harvest the corn. You're going to shuck it on the way in. And it's going to be like 2 minutes from the time you pull it off the stalk to when it's boiling, you know, so it's going to be a lot, you know, the sugar content, the flavors are going to be much, much better. Tomato eaten in the garden is much better than a tomato eaten in any other environment.
I know a huckleberry off the bush is better than any pre-picked pint that you buy from anybody.
From anybody, yeah.
True.
Now, the fact that you had to hike 10 miles in to find it is, you know, probably had something to do with it.
The thing, I love about the Master Gardeners is they're so helpful. It's their literal mission to help others. How can people get, you have people like I was told to ask about my roses and when I should prune them and whatnot. And we're probably not going to get to that because it's probably a bigger mission than any of us have time for. But how can people reach out? How can people get answers to their questions?
So first place, you can look at the Master Gardener website, you know, DouglasCountyMasterGardeners.org, I believe. Or just search Douglas County Master Gardeners. The website will come up. And we publish our classes on there. OSU Extension, Douglas County OSU Extension is another place you can go and see the classes there. On your particular thing, there's a class every year on pruning roses and the care of roses. We go out to the Discovery Garden there at River Forks, and, you know, they trim roses. The guy talks about trimming the roses.
Okay.
We have a pavilion series that we do, part of the OSU program, you know, led by Logan Bennett there. Every month, sometimes twice a month, we'll have some program there. It's absolutely free. Come out a couple hours, and we try, to the extent that we can, we try to do a hands-on, this is how you do it. And it's on all kinds of different subjects, composting, vermiculture, you know, growing, using worms to eat your vegetable scraps. I do one on doing, you know, planting garlic and shallots and that, growing garlics and shallots and that kind of thing. We're doing a series. We're calling it part of the pavilion series, but it's going to be, weather's likely to be nasty, but in February and March, we're doing class on starting your tomatoes from seed. We'll do it in one of our greenhouses, talk you through the process, and whoever comes will go home with a little pot of 9 tomato seeds or 9 pepper seeds that they'll germinate. And then a few weeks later, we'll do a class on how to get them out of those little pots into their own individual pots. So there's a bunch of those kind of classes sprinkled through the year. OSU has a whole bunch of video classes that you can go watch. Most of them were done live stream, but then they're saved and you can go and watch those. So there's a lot of that kind of thing you can do. We have a plant clinic. You'd have to look at the OSU or the Master Gardener website to find out what the hours are. So if you're looking at your roses and they've got this little translucent bug on them and you say, I don't know what that is, you could pick that, look at when the hours are and come in and they'll tell you what that insect is and whether it's something you ought to treat or something you ought to leave alone. You got a little black spot on your rose leaf, you know, you got a little black stem on your tomato plant, bring it in, they'll diagnose it and tell you what's going on. The other thing you could do, we're a self-funded organization for the most part. Mm-hmm. We do get some technical support out of OSU and some office space out of OSU. But for all of our operations, the classes and all that kind of stuff, we're self-funded. And so there's a big plant sale. We do the first weekend in May at the fairgrounds. When we come to that plant sale, we'll bring between 6,000 and 8,000 plants to that sale. Most of them sell out, thankfully. And it's not just master gardeners. We have a community of vendors that come to that sale selling all kinds of garden-related things. They sell their own plants. They sell tools, decorations for your garden, right, all kinds of things like that. Coming up here in March, we have a program we call Spring in the Garden. It'll be out at the Phoenix School. I forget which day it is. I want to say it's the 9th of March. It's the early part of March, a Saturday, the early part of March. Once again, it's on our website. You know, that's another big opportunity. That's a day's worth of classes where we teach people different things. I'm going to be doing something on seed saving, how to save tomato seeds and pepper seeds. And we're going to do an apple grafting class. There'll be composting classes. There'll be, you know, classes on maintaining your oak forest and all kinds of different things. That's always a good training experience to come out for.
Bruce, this has been fantastic. I am so motivated to do better next year. I did a horrible job this time.
Let me recommend two books that I think have been very, very helpful to me. And they're written in a way that'd be very helpful for people that are just getting started.
Okay.
So they're both a good starting and a reference. They're what I like. They're diametrically opposed recommendations. So you get the balance. You know, nobody writes a book that doesn't have an agenda, right? So if you read one book and you go by that, you're buying into their agenda. This gives you two different ways of looking at it. One, which I find is the most helpful specifically for our environment, is Growing Vegetables West of the Cascades. And that's written by Steve Solomon. And these are always, you know, like everything's available on Amazon. But that's an excellent book. Not only does it go into how to prepare your soil and all the things you can do to your soil and all that kind of stuff, it also has very detailed guides about every different kind of vegetable you might want to grow and recommendations on varieties and when to plant and when not to plant, all that kind of thing. Let me go back and say, keep your own notes. So my recommendation is every time you're done in the garden, have your notebook there. Done what you're going to do. You're tired. You've had enough. Kick back, clean your hands, and get your notebook and write something down about what your observations were today. What did you notice today? If you never, ever even go back and look at those notes, it causes you to spend that moment reflecting and saying, what was that? What? Yeah, those tomato plants looked unhappy. They just looked down in the mouth, down in the leaf. You know, wonder what I need to think on that. And just make yourself a little note that says, you know, tomato plants didn't look great. Then I have the problem of immediately wanting to go up and do something. But, you know, you went out the next day, you know, stick your finger in the soil and 3 or 4 inches, it's still bone dry. Well, they're sad because they're dry. If you put your finger in the soil and it's like sopping wet, you go, oh, they're sad because they're drowning. All right, I'll stop that. So that's Growing Vegetables West of the Cascades by Steve Solomon. Great, great thing. The other one, which is not that specific to the Pacific Northwest, but is excellent in trying to get the most out of your garden space, is a book called How to Grow More Vegetables. And the subtitle is Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Could Ever Imagine. And where Steve Solomon is going to recommend spreading your plants out, giving them all perfect amount of space, this book is going to describe how tightly you can pack them and why there's an advantage to tacking them very tightly.
Okay.
So where I follow Steve's recommendations in terms of what to plant and how to think about winter gardening and how to think about, you know, the different times of season and when to kind of get things going and the kind of soils you've got and how to deal with some of the soils. I use how to grow more vegetables to get the most vegetables I can out of the amount of space I have. Because I am kind of limited in my garden space. I've got about 7,000 square foot of garden space. Mm-hmm. I'm joking.
I was doing the addition in my head, thinking about the size of our house, and I'm not really good with square foot, but I'm thinking that's larger than our.
It is a very large garden. And I do supply quite a bit of food to the food banks. And, you know, there's several elderly couples around the valley that get little care packages during the season. Otherwise, I'd just be drowning in vegetables.
Right. Bruce, this has been fantastic. I'm so excited to try again next year. Thank you so much for your time. This has been fantastic. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. We've been speaking with Bruce Gravens, Master Gardener. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any part in our series, you can find our shows at umpquawatersheds.org, and thank you for listening.